Welcome to The Advocacy Scoop, the podcast that takes you inside the advocacy work of the National Association of Realtors, connecting 1.5 million members with their advocates in Washington for a front row seat to the fight for public policy that strengthens the ability of Americans to access property ownership.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Advocacy Scoop podcast. I'm Patrick Newton, NAR's Director of Advocacy Communications. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, NAR's Chief Advocacy Officer, Shannon McGann.
Thank you, Patrick. It's great to be back. Happy New Year. Happy new season of the podcast.
Happy New Year. It's season two. And you know what? This is going to be a taxing year.
Is that a dad joke?
It absolutely
is. Good one. Good one.
I love dad jokes. But we're tackling this right out of the gate in our podcast series because this year, tax reform is going to be the most impactful thing that we do this decade, probably.
No pressure.
No pressure. the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that President Trump's tax reform bill from 2017, that is up for renewal. And before 2017, we did not touch the tax code in this sort of level until the 1980s.
Used to be a once every 30 something years. Now every 8 years, I guess.
That's right. So TCJA, we're going to allow an acronym in this episode. I will not acronym police you, but some of the key features of the TCJA going to expire this year. The corporate tax rate was made permanent, but most of the individual rates for households and individuals were actually temporary.
Can you tell me what TCJA stands for?
Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
You got it. Okay.
So we're going to go back in time to 2017. Picture it, Congress, 2017. Once in a generation tax reform. We were on it in very different ways. So I guess my first question for you, Shannon, because you were right in the thick of it back then. Reconcile me this. Why 8 years?
So yes, picture it. I was right there in the House cloakroom as the House of Representatives voted on the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. I was working at the Treasury Department at the time and was part of the efforts at the White House to grab coalition partners and to make sure that everyone had a seat at the table and what this is going to entail. And time flies when you're having fun because that feels like yesterday. And now we're going to go right back into it in 2025. So reconciliation, it's a big word for what is supposed to be a pretty simple process. It is a budget process that allows the Senate to pass budget-related bills using a simple majority vote instead of having to get through the filibuster, which is 60 votes. So that those 60 votes are hard to come by when you're looking for bipartisan support. If you're looking for partisan support, 50 votes are a lot easier. But we and realtor advocacy are always looking for bipartisan support in any of the policies that we are advocating for. So our hope is that we would be able to, if not get those votes out there, but to at least make sure that there are provisions that are going to be supported in a bipartisan way.
And budget reconciliation is not all positives, no negatives. There are some limitations to it. And one of it is like you cannot really go outside the 10-year budget window with what you are passing, which is why we are doing this all over again.
So that is one reason why, and not to be cynical, but I am a DC lobbyist. So that's what I do. But also I think when you're looking at those provisions that are ending, it's kind of a, you know, we dare you. This is going to come up in 8 years and it will be up to another Congress to say, are you going to support extending these provisions or are you going to raise taxes on Americans? So a little bit of it is a game of political chicken.
I mean, is that why they made the corporate tax rate permanent in the bill, but they made the individual tax rates temporary because they knew they wouldn't let taxes go up on an everyday American?
It's probably an easier political sell to say the individual rates need to be reconsidered. And I think it also just looks at the score and the Congressional Budget Office. I mean, we all are balancing checkbooks and understand what our household budget looks like. It is an incredibly convoluted budget when you're looking at how things score and how to project out for 10 years. And so our job is to think about those things for you and work within those windows of opportunity and find out where we can get some housing inventory affordability measures included in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
And the score you're talking about, so when you use budget reconciliation, the first thing that they have to do is come up with a number and be like, this is the number that we're willing to spend on this piece of legislation. And then you've got to fit everything into the bill, into that number.
Exactly. And when you say they, it's a really fun process. I was the longtime staff director at the House Financial Services Committee. So the budget committee will send instructions to each committee and say, your job is to find coins in the couch cushions and find anything that you have that you can say would hit these reconciliation instructions. So it really is a game the whole family can play. And everybody is involved in finding those savings. And we have been hard at work in over the last two Congresses and looking at where we could potentially find some.
And think about everything that was in TCJA. So it lowered all the tax brackets, created a much larger standard deduction, created a larger child tax credit, limited SALT, restricted the mortgage interest deduction, raised the estate tax threshold, reduced the number of households subject to the alternative minimum tax, and it created a generous deduction for business owners whose business income passes through to their personal. So
just like our independent contractor, sole proprietor members.
But all that added up and it had to fit in that number. And so, you know, that brings me to my next question. Now that we know the process that they used back in 2017, you know, grab your flux capacitor, hop in the DeLorean, you know, set the dial to 2017. You were working in the Treasury Department at the time. So just tell me, like, how did this all unfold?
Whenever I hear DeLorean, I always think I have that actual license plate replica at home. Out of time, but we are not out of time. We have been planning for this for the last several Congresses. So what happened in the presidential campaign this year where you had candidate Donald Trump who ran on the idea that taxes were too high and that he would reduce them. And you have Republicans who, you know, won control not only of the White House, but also a majority of the House and Senate. So that's what 2017 looked like. It's looking very similar now that we're in 2025 and moving towards the same tax debates, but with a very, very narrow majority in the House. So back in 2017, both the House and Senate began with the intent of achieving both of these budget reconciliation instructions. How do we get forward on any type of tax reform? And a lot of folks thought that it wasn't going to happen. There's a reason why it hadn't happened since the 1980s, and that's because it's incredibly difficult and incredibly costly. But where there's a will, there's a way. And I think we're coming to a very similar political climate where these extensions are going to happen. It's just a matter of how much can get through.
Well, that brings me to question number three, Shannon, and it is an easy one. It is true or false. So true or false, you get everything you want in a bill this big.
Well, it depends on who you are and it depends on what you're asking for. So the answer is false. I'm so sorry to bring that negative news. But back in 2017, NAR went to the table and had some really big wins and some losses. And it was a massive bill. The losses were that against the advice of NAR, the supporters of TCJA decided to deliver much of the tax cuts from the bill from doubling the standard deduction, which that sounds great. Doubling the standard deduction means more people are getting to keep more in their paycheck, but it also means that fewer people are using the mortgage interest deduction and the property tax deduction, which are two that property owners are using the most of. So in effect, that meant that far fewer people were using them and that the idea of owning a home versus renting a home, there were just fewer tax incentives to do that. The placing the cap on the state and local tax deduction, SALT, we're a little salty about that. The impact of the big increase in the standard deduction was making that even worse, that you're not going to deduct state and local. I always thought that was a bit unfair because the tax base should be with your state and local government, not with your federal government. So you're essentially paying taxes on your taxes. So the maximum amount of a mortgage loan, the interest of which could be deductible, was lowered from $1 million to $750,000. The existing loans were still included in there, so that wasn't too bad, but you know, that $750,000, home values are going up. That doesn't get you as far as it used to.
So sort of devaluing the mortgage interest deduction and the cap on the state and local taxes, those were probably the two biggest losses. But, you know, we did come out of that bill with some significant wins as well.
Very significant wins. So the final bill included a 20% deduction on business income of independent contractors. So there was a great deal of doubt about whether or not real estate brokers and agents could qualify for it, but indeed they did. NAR worked very closely back then with the Treasury Department in the Office of Management and Budget. I know that sounds like an exciting place to work, to make sure that real estate brokers weren't qualifying for that deduction. This also included opportunity zones, which we long supported, still support. They provide special capital gains tax incentives to invest in distressed neighborhoods throughout America. So that generated a lot of excitement, a lot of investments, especially for commercial real estate.
Well, let's stop rehashing the past. Go back to the future, or the present, I should say. What is on the table this year with tax reform that is the most important as far as our advocacy priorities? Because we know what our wins and losses were 8 years ago. But our advocacy priorities, especially the ones that you have set for us around accessibility, availability, and affordability, are now part of the discussion this go around.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Patrick. My job is to communicate and message these priorities, but we have more committees than Congress. And so our taxation committee and others have been working for years to make sure that we have policies in place that can we can advocate for during this incredibly important time. So we're looking to see that tax reform happens that will include the 20% standard deduction, just make sure that that is extended, renewal of opportunity zones, maintain the high threshold for the estate tax exclusion, a significant increase in the SALT deduction cap, and the end of the marriage penalty. If you switch it from $10,000 to $20,000 for a married couple, that covers a lot more folks, and especially in those high cost areas.
And that would be a pretty... You know, if we did, if all we got out of it was the end of the marriage penalty, that would be good. But there's also discussion about raising it as well or indexing it.
Exactly. And so, it could just end. But I think that they are going to need the pay fors, as they're called, as part of that. So but we have wide bipartisan support, especially with even folks on the Ways and Means Committee to either end SALT or to include that marriage penalty or I guess remove the marriage penalty.
Well, in addition to those issues, which sort of came up last time, we're also hoping, you know, that Congress will use tax reform to help with the affordability crisis, because a lot of these solutions for increasing inventory run through the tax code.
Exactly. And so that's what our policy committees have been working on. And we have bipartisan support for many of these. The More Homes on the Market Act, which if you've been listening to The Scoop, you are familiar with this, which doubles the capital gains exemption to sell a property. Many folks who bought back in the 80s, 90s and had a really good deal on it are going to have a huge capital gains penalty if they sell now. And so that helps to index it better towards where the current market is. The Neighborhood Homes Investment Act, which is kind of like the opportunity zones, but for housing, expansion of the low-income housing tax credit, the Revitalizing Downtowns and Main Streets Act, which is helps to do commercial conversion into residential properties, reducing capital gains taxes for owners of rental homes who would like to sell them to first-time homebuyers who will be owner-occupants. One that comes up all the time, that protecting 1031 like-kind exchanges. So that was made permanent as part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, but that doesn't mean, permanent doesn't mean anything in politics, as we know. So if-
And we saved that for real estate.
Yes. So it was on the chopping block for potentially for real estate and any other areas where capital gains kicks in. But we saved it for real estate. But there's always folks who want to potentially use that as a pay for. And so making sure that that is protected, fighting against changes in the taxation of carried interest and opposing any new taxes on tax exempt organizations and trade associations like us and all of our industry partners.
And you just rattled off all these bills and I want to point this out because in our last episode, when we talked about our wins for 2024, one of our legislative team's wins was that we had the most bipartisan housing legislation introduced. And that's sort of how we do it. Like we worked on these bills for years and sometimes in multiple Congresses to get them crafted, to get them introduced. Then you build the co-sponsors up into a good number so that when something like this comes along, you have these bills put in a larger bill.
Exactly. Congress is not always the fastest moving of the governance bodies, but when they hear about something over and over and can have hearings on it, roundtables, we've had the opportunity to go around the country and have meetings with members of Congress in their district. What was the stat you gave me? We had more than 5,000 of these last year, contacts, meetings, connections with members of Congress around the country. And so these are the types of issues that come up during those times. So none of this should be a surprise to anyone. The real question is, what are the budget capabilities as we move forward? And we'll be at the table walking through all of it.
Well, you know, we're not done with the DeLorean yet. So set the dial to 2026. When the dust settles, Shannon, like, how do you think this is going to go for us? Because we now know we have a GOP government trifecta, House, Senate, and the presidency. How do you think that will benefit us? And how do you think that will hurt us? And then also, like, how are you approaching this differently than NAR did back in 2017.
Well, the real focus on the relationships and meetings and leveraging the immense preparation that we have done to meet this moment. Litigating this in public is probably not the way to go. We've been educating policymakers for years on this. And so we've had a great deal of information and resources. You can find all of this on flyin.realtor. These have been federal priorities for the last Congress and more. So it's theoretically possible for a united majority of both the House and Senate to come together on the budget reconciliation resolution, open up the door and see where these could be extended. So I think a minimum package would be extending SALT potentially. I don't think they have the votes for that, extending many of these provisions. But you are going to see some partisan fighting. That is the nature of this process. We have great leadership at the Ways and Means Committee, where any tax bill needs to start, with a chairman, Jason Smith, and a ranking member, Richie Neal. So making sure that they are able to, and their teams can talk together and focus on how do we get to the policy solutions that open up housing inventory and affordability. That 20% deduction on qualified business income is widely supported, but we got to make sure that it's bipartisanly supported. Most of the tax increases that we've been fighting, that Evan Lydiard, who has forgotten more than I'll ever know on taxes, he has been absolute phenomenal subject matter expert and advocate for NAR. He calls them the ugly 11. Just search those on our website and you can find those ugly 11, making sure that we're getting those off the table. President Trump has said that he supports repealing SALT. And so that's a change from the last time. So that's another opening there. We're also likely to see continued support for 1099A provisions that benefit independent contractors, real estate professionals, things like I mentioned before on carried interest and capital gains. We're also out there supporting savings accounts for first-time homebuyers. We know that that's one of the, we talked to the American Property Owners Alliance that is communicating with property owners around the country day in and day out. And that's one of the big concerns, is just having the ability to maintain your home and to have a down payment for a home. So looking at potential ways to help them save.
Okay. Well, those are some positives with the GOP trifecta, but what are some of the downfalls of having one party in total control?
Oh, gosh. So I've gone through this process several times over. There tends to be some partisan divide. Who knew? This can happen sometimes. So we always prefer bipartisan solutions to the partisan ones. But often, especially when there's a razor thin margin, folks tend to look to how do you get all of one party before you even worry about the other. So maybe because of that razor thin margin, that means trying to pull, Republicans will work more with Democrats and pull them over. But that is what we're hoping for. And that is what we'll advocate for. It may be harder for some of these solutions to pass if, for instance, like the More Homes on the Market Act has twice as much of support from Democrats than it does Republicans right now. But also with the new makeup of Congress, we might see more people co-sponsor it. So there are just some of those areas that we want to make sure that we're going in eyes wide open, that it's not all sunshine and rainbows. And now here's their tax bills. It's going to get done by the end of this year.
Well, we talk about the trade-offs and the pay-fors. We mentioned a second ago, you don't get everything that you want in a bill this big. So they do have to pay for what they're proposing and passing and meet that number that they come up with.
So Patrick, we'll have to tell our dear audience what a budget nerd you are. Do they know this about your professional history?
I did spend several years at a budget think tank analyzing the federal budget, or at least doing communications. The nerds are the ones that analyzed it. And I say that in the most lovingly way possible, because I love to nerd out and hang out with people way smarter than me.
Well, so reconciliation is the time for the budget nerds to shine. And so this is coming up with those trade-offs and those pay-fors and things are very difficult. One area that was mentioned back in 2017 and is coming up again is recapping and releasing the GSEs. Fannie and Freddie have been in a conservatorship since the financial crisis. So some folks are saying, is it too soon? Do they have the funding to be recapitalized? And then could that be used as a potential pay-for? So we are following that one very closely. And also, if anything does happen in the GSE space, ensuring that those savings are going to housing-related measures and not used as a pay-for unrelated tax cuts that could happen down the road. So we're keeping a very, very close eye and talking to all of the relevant leaders on that one. But these are very high stakes, very intense negotiations that will be happening. But we are incredibly well-positioned in the House, in the Senate, and with the administration to make sure that our voice voices being heard.
And to know like the kind of numbers we're talking about here. So making TCJA permanent. So just taking the what passed in 2017 and saying it's permanent, $4.6 trillion over 10 years. But if you take all the tax cuts that President Trump promised during the campaign,
no tax on tips,
you know, like doing away with salt, the number goes up to $7 trillion. These are astronomical numbers. And the dynamic has changed because, you know, in 2017, these were new laws they were passing. These were new tax measures. And now these have existed for 8 years and people are used to them. And so now like you said a minute ago, nobody wants taxes to go up dramatically for Americans overnight. So it's like there's a different leverage there.
And also, you could tax everyone 100% and it's not going to be enough to get out of our budget deficits. So the real issue here is how do you create these types of tax cuts that are incentivizing things like property ownership that add to the economy? 20% of the GDP is coming from the real estate economy. And so if more folks are able to develop property, to buy and sell property, that brings more economic income, more tax dollars back. We see that with 1031. I think 19% more comes back in the final sale of 1031, thanks to there being that tax deferral. So,
and if you go to flyin.realtor, we have all these fast facts on real estate economic numbers. This is the stuff that our in-house research team comes up with, our economists and our research group. It's a resource for realtors and members of Congress. We have research reports, papers, case studies, surveys, trends, activities, I mean, historical, where, you know, forecasts of where things are going to be in a year. I mean, policymakers use this stuff because we do something groundbreaking. We break it down into their district.
Exactly. Our research team just posted a blog about property taxes. And it goes state by state in 2023 to track everything as it relates to salt. So we're not going in cold to these meetings. That we know what the solutions are and we're ready to sell it.
Yeah, we have fresh reports that we come up with. We have our legacy reports, like, you know, things like our home buyers and sellers, generational trends, you know, wealth gains. We snapshot of home buying, of race and home buying in America. We just have had these landmark studies that we've put out. The Rosen Report that we did several years ago was literally the national alarm bell on the housing affordability crisis. And so this is like one of your top three advocacy priorities is promoting this.
This is going to be a very busy 2025. And our dear federal political coordinators who are coming into town soon and experiencing what these meetings are going to look like, we're all becoming tax and budget experts.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, here we are. It's a happy new year. We're here in January. We have so much coming up in the next couple of weeks. We've got our inaugural Advocacy Week event coming up. Now, I hesitate to mention it because it's not open to all members. It's a training conference for some of our leadership, but I mention it because, you know, it's the kind of thing that you can become involved with if you want to get on a leadership track as a member.
Yes, and it's important that you know that we are working on this around the clock, around the year. So we've got our Advocacy Week, and you said inaugural. Well, it also happens to be right after the presidential inauguration. So this is going to be a very interesting time to find hotel rooms. But thankfully, Patrick was on top of this, and we had locked in some hotel space.
So it's the inaugural Advocacy
Week. And so this is combining the Realtor Party Training Conference, our Policy Forum, our FPC Training Conference, and
our PPCC, Coordinating Committee.
Public Policy Coordinating Committee meetings. And so this is where the work gets done to help develop from all of our committee leadership and federal political coordinators and others to make sure that we are prepared for the year, that we have meetings lined up, and that our federal policy priorities are all updated on flyin.realtor, and we're ready to hit the hill running.
Well, it's closing time. We talked about the inauguration, so I think it'd be great. I've lived in D.C. 18 years.
20-something years.
So tell me your favorite inauguration story.
Oh, my goodness. I've been around for many. I went to school here in D.C., and so the first one I went to was in 2001 when I was, I think, a junior at the George Washington University, and it is an absolute blur. And, you know, no one had camera phones or anything back then, so I have zero pictures, zero proof of anything. of this happening. But I do remember just being able to kind of bounce around to different parties and thinking that, oh, this is what life is like in DC all the time. It is not. No, it is in every 4 years. And the traffic was not that bad back then. But now it gets a little crazy. Most folks I know try to get out of town because it's just a total madhouse. But I'm a political nerd, not a budget one. I love this stuff. So excited to be around for it. How about yours?
President Trump's first inauguration. I live not too far from the Capitol. You can pretty much see it from my front door. And it's weird because you're walking down the street and they put these fences up along the streets. And it's like you're walking through cages because there's a fence going down one side of the street and the other side of the street. And so you have to stay onto the sidewalks. You can't really cross.
Oh, you're
the
like
street.
Parade route area.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But I remember I was walking down and I was like in the street and I couldn't get onto the sidewalk and it was around and I was in a tuxedo and I was on my way to this. It was the Right to Bear Arts Ball, which was this,
that.
I know, but it was like a friend of mine invited me to it. And there was like a bunch of celebrities were in town to advocate for funding for the arts. And so I go to this thing and I'm just like nerding out with all these celebrities. And
yes, celebrities do come to town for it's not just for the politicos.
Yeah. You know, I think it's going to be really cool at Advocacy Week that our members will be here 2 days after the inauguration. And we planned it that way, not to be difficult, but because it's the start of a new Congress. It's the start of a new administration. These are folks that are being trained for the Realtor Party and our FPCs who work with their members of Congress. And so we wanted them to be here with us and experience all that and see the fences and all the electricity that comes with all of that. It's like being in New Orleans on Mardi Gras. I mean, yeah, you don't want to.
It's not that fun, but yeah.
Or it's maybe more like being in Times Square on New Year's Eve. It's chaotic and you want to do it one time and then never again.
I can follow that.
So we'll see some folks here in a couple of weeks at Advocacy Week, and we'll be back in February with our next episode of the podcast, where we're going to dissect the 119th Congress, the committees, the chairpersons, the members that we supported that got elected, and all of the work that we're doing with this new Congress and what it looks like. So,
I'm looking forward to that. We'll break it all down.
All right, cool. Well, thank you so much, and we'll see you in February. So that's The Scoop. Thank you to everyone listening to this podcast. Please be sure to subscribe and share wherever you get your podcast, and meet us right back here for more Advocacy Scoop next time.
Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.